MechCast, Friday, January 8th, 2015. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Well, again, you know, I often wonder if we should go back and change that intro. I think we can't at this point. After 11 years, are we allowed to do that? Because really what we talk about on the show is anything Apple-related, Mac, iOS, iPad, iPhone. You see, back when I started the show so long ago, we didn't have all this other stuff, right? It was just Apple and Mac, and they were pretty much synonymous. That's the name of the show and all the other stuff. I think we stick with history and then stick with the standard intro, but I'd be curious to get your thoughts on that. Is it time to change, or are we change averse? Most people don't like a lot of change. We'll keep it the same for now. Anyway, how you doing? Welcome back. New year, new shows to do for you. Excited about what's happening, although, frankly, the Apple news, Mac news, has been a little bit light as of late. We have a few things to talk about, so should be an okay show. Plus, we've got all the great feedback from you and questions and stuff like that. CES is going on, so there's a few little tidbits coming out of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. We'll be talking about those a little bit. We've got more rumors about what's up next for Apple, specifically mostly iPhones, a few little iPad rumors thrown in there just to add a little bit of seasoning. Going to talk about AT&T and contracts. There's some changes going on there. So if you're an AT&T customer, you might be interested in that. And also, we have some more details about the technology that's in the Apple Pencil. And that was pretty cool to hear about and see. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And a longstanding member of the Mac community, software developer, it looks like they are, I'm not sure if they're leaving us, but at the very least, there's a product that's no longer available. A little bit of a sad note, but we're going to get into that and talk about that a little bit. And that'll roll right into some of the feedback and questions, because we're going to talk about some applications, people looking for some replacements from some older apps that have gone away. I have a little correction on something I mentioned on the last episode about the Genius Bar. Actually, kind of a little apology that I need to make. And we're going to talk about iMessages and how to find old messages. Also, remote access from your iPad back to your Mac. Going to get into that a little bit as well. So lots of good things to talk about. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, look. If you're looking to get a new device, you want a new iPhone, an iPad, an Apple Watch, something like that, chances are, because we're all tech geeks here, right? Chances are you have some old devices lying around, maybe an old iPhone, an old iPad. And if you want to get some cash for that old device that you can use to buy a new one, Gazelle is a perfect place to go and do that. You can use it for a new iPad Pro, a new Apple TV, whatever you'd like. And what I love about Gazelle, and I've been using them for years, is that they make it free and easy to get an offer for your old device. All you have to do is look at what you have, go on to gazelle.com, answer a few easy questions about your device, and right there they'll give you an instant price quote. They'll say, hey, we'll give you this much money for it. And it's completely risk-free. You don't have to take it, but if you do, they make it real easy to send your device in and to get paid quickly. And plus, they'll also buy broken devices. So you got a cracked screen? Don't worry about that either. Throw it in there and see if they can give you some cash for that. Very often they can, and they will make you the offer and they'll honor it for 30 days. So you can lock it in, see it right there. And many times they will provide you a box and the shipping is always free. So they cover that. And all of your personal information is also removed from your device. So you can do that before you send it in, or when they receive it, they'll process it and they'll take care of that. Like I said, they make it as simple as possible. And you get paid fast. Once they receive your device, they're going to look it over, make sure it is in the condition and has all the accessories that you said it did. And if that's the case, you will get a check either in the mail, you can get a direct deposit to your PayPal account, or you can opt for an Amazon gift card. And if you go that route, I think they give you 5% more on your offer. It is a really great service, and they've serviced over 1 million customers. They've paid out over $200 million to those customers, so they have a great reputation. Like I said, I've used them many times to get cash for my old devices, and it's great. I absolutely love it. So check out Gazelle, gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Let's get into what's happening with next generation iPhones. Some of the rumors, we've been talking about those for the past couple weeks. This week, a somewhat dubious claim came out from the typical supply chain sources that we get a lot of these rumors from. And it came out that there might be, this time around, a 256 gigabyte storage option on the iPhone, at least on the Plus model. So this would be an option on the higher end model. It came from a Chinese site called My Drivers. We don't know a lot about them. I don't know what their reputation has been in the past, but recently we've been getting a few different rumors from this source. And they did make a claim in the past. Remember the iPad Mini? When the iPad Mini was first coming out, this was one site that said it was going to be as thin as an iPad 2 and have a sharp IGZO display. Remember when we were talking about all that IGZO display technology that never came to be? Yeah, so we're going to take this rumor with a grain of salt. I think there's a lot of people that would like a 256 gigabyte option on their iPhone. For me, I think 128 has been more than enough storage on my iPhone. I was always pushing the limits on my 64 gig. But 128 is good enough, and I think Apple's going to stick at those sizes. Again, I still hope they're going to get rid of the 16 gigabyte, but Apple seems to like that for the enterprise market and just for the lower price point and higher margin that they make on that. So they may not get rid of that quite yet, but I'd like to see 32, 64, 128. Chances are, though, really, I think what we're going to see, 16 gig, 64 gig, 128, just like we have today. I'm really not holding my breath for a 256, but that rumor is out there now. The same site also seems to believe that Apple will increase the iPhone 7 Plus battery up about 12% to 3,100 milliamp hours. The last update, though, Apple actually reduced the size of the battery to save some of the thickness and weight. So there's always that trade-off of when you're adding more battery, yeah, you're going to get a little bit more battery life out of it, but you're adding weight, you're adding potential thickness, all of those things. And Apple seems to be wanting to go thinner and lighter in most cases. And really, they tweak the software to kind of optimize the battery for new models. So don't know if they'll up the battery size, but hopefully they'll at least up the battery life. They tend to try to do that, or at least keep it the same at the very, I guess, worst case scenario. Another thing that we've been hearing is that Apple might be switching the material they use for the case. It may or may not be metal. It's not clear what it's going to be at this point. They're just calling it a composite material. To me, that sounds like it would be more of a plastic. And the idea here would be that they would be able to remove the antenna lines, something I've never been a big fan of in terms of the design, although I've gotten used to it. When I first saw it, and you can go back and listen to these episodes, I really hated it. I really didn't like it at all. But you know, I've gotten used to it. That doesn't mean I absolutely love it. And so it would be great if they could make them go away, although I'm not sure how I feel about them moving to more of a plastic-like case. I like the metal casing. I like the styling of it. I like the look of it. I think it adds to the high-end premium feel of the iPhone versus some other devices. So I'm hoping that doesn't go away, but we'll have to see. Another big rumor is that it's going to be waterproof this time around. So with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus, Apple did a number of things, including adding some gaskets and seals around some of the openings to improve the water resistance of the iPhone, but it's not completely waterproof yet. And we're hearing that the iPhone 7 may be completely waterproof. And there's some other things that they're doing we're going to talk about in a little bit that may enable them to do that. And I think that would be a good move on Apple's part. These things get dropped in puddles. They go in the rain. A lot of people like to take them on, you know, skiing, on boats, those sorts of things. So it'd be nice if you could at least have it fall in the water for a little bit and not get ruined. I had one one of my iPhones ruined when I accidentally jumped in the pool with it. Didn't realize it. And it was only a few seconds that it was underwater, but that was enough to totally kill it. So it'd be nice if we could not have to worry about that anymore. And it sounds like with the iPhone 7 series, that may no longer be an issue. Another thing we've been hearing a lot about is the display. There's always this back and forth. Is Apple going to move to a new display technology? Specifically, the one that's cited most frequently is OLED. Apple's never done a product with OLED display up until the point of the Apple Watch, which does have an OLED display. And OLED displays tend to be on smaller devices, although we're seeing some phone models now that have OLED displays. And we've had a few different models on the Android side for a while. So a lot of people have been wondering, is Apple going to make the switch away from the IPS TFT displays that they use now? I don't think they're going to do that for the iPhone 7 model, but Apple is supposedly sealing up contracts right now with some of their display providers for OLED displays, although it's not expected that those are going to arrive in any Apple devices before 2018. So really what I think we're seeing in the supply chain is Apple just putting together some contracts. Some of the suppliers also, in order to meet the to be able to meet the demand at the high volumes that Apple would need for an iPhone, they're going to have to ramp up their production. So they're building new facilities, they're putting new processes in place, and that's what's going on. The new displays in the iPhone 7, though, are expected to use something called in-cell display technology that would enable Apple to make them even thinner. And there's one rumor that says the iPhone 7 might even be as thin as the iPod Touch, just 6.1 millimeters. This is another one of those things that's a little bit of a catch-22, because if they make it thinner, chances are they're going to also lose a little bit of battery space, a little bit of compartment space. And I think Apple's already pushing the edge of the limits on where we're willing to go in terms of battery life. I would not want to get any less battery life just to have a slimmer iPhone. I don't think they need to be thinner, but that is one of the things that's being thrown out there. We've also got the renewed rumors that the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack might go away and be replaced. And one of the reasons that's cited for Apple possibly wanting to do that would be to, again, make the device even thinner. Because you're pretty much at the limit, although, again, the iPod Touch is just a hair thinner, I think, than the current iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. Now, if they remove that headphone jack, the idea would be is that Apple wants to also get an all-digital connection for audio. And why would they want to do that? Well, you could have better quality audio, but also bring in new functionality. A rumor we heard this week is that Apple might be looking into some noise-canceling technology that would be integrated both in hardware and software, and hardware both on the iPhone side as well as the headphone side. And it would allow them to have noise canceling. And not only that, they would be able to license that technology to third-party headphone manufacturers. So I would expect that we would see it first in Apple headphones and possibly Beats headphones, because Apple now owns Beats. And then third parties could license the same noise canceling technology to include in their earphones and their earbuds and things like that. So they'd be able to do a lot more stuff if they can go with this all-digital connector. Now, many people are not happy about this rumor about the loss of a 3.5 millimeter jack. For me, I don't think it's that big of an issue. I mostly use Bluetooth headphones now. I prefer not having the wires. And I would suspect that if Apple does make the switch, that they're going to have lightning options available, lightning connector options for headphones. About the only thing that I worry about a little bit is not being able to charge and have headphones plugged in at the same time. That might require some sort of weird splitters or dongles, and I'm never a big fan of those. But, you know, I don't think this is going to break a lot of people, and I think Apple's going to be able to go through this transition. But still, there's a number of people that aren't happy, and this week we heard a story. SomeOfUs.org, SomeOfUs.org, apparently has this petition. They claim that over 200,000 people have signed the petition imploring Apple to keep the 3.5 millimeter jack. I don't think I'm that attached to it. I don't know how you feel about it, but is this really that big a deal? I know we've got older legacy phones. I would imagine if Apple does make the switch, there will be some kind of digital to analog, you know, lightning to 3.5 millimeter adapter that they sell, probably in the $20 range. So it's not going to be cheap. But again, I think they're going to throw a box, a set of ear AirPods or something in the box, because they've always included with iPhones headphones, or I think they have for the last few models. I don't remember if I got them with my iPhone 6S. Now, come to think of it, I'd have to check in on that. But I think with iPhones, you still get headphones. If not, if Apple is making a transition, it's sounding like they would throw in some Lightning-connected earpods. At least 9 to 5 Mac claims that Apple would be doing that with the iPhone 7 when they get rid of the 3.5-millimeter jack. And I think they would have to. That would just ease the transition. There's also this really cool rumor that Apple is developing their own set of Bluetooth in-ear headphones that would have no cord at all. And not only that, it would have individual earpieces, so there'd be no cord connecting the two headphones. I have a set of Jaybird Bluetooth headphones that I really like a lot that somebody gave to me, and they were a great gift. I love them. But they have this little wire that goes from side to side. These would be like little, they look like individual almost Bluetooth earpieces. Put one in each ear, and then they would sync up and be totally integrated with your new iPhone. And not only that, users would charge them in a little special carrying case that came with it. So you have a carrying case that you plug in, you dock, it charges your little ear pods or earbuds, whatever they're going to be called. As a matter of fact, if you remember, and I think Apple Insider pointed this out, Apple back in October filed for a trademark for AirPods. And there was some speculation at that point that that might be a Bluetooth version of Apple's EarPods. So sounds like this might come to be, and it would be an accessory that would launch with the iPhone 7. They wouldn't be included. So in the box, you'd get wired lightning connected EarPods, and then Apple would also simultaneously launch these new Bluetooth headphones. And it's unclear whether Apple would do it under the Apple brand or if it'd be under Beats. But I would imagine if they use that AirPods trademark and that is the name of the thing, then they would be branded as Apple. But fully expect some lightning connected and possibly Bluetooth connected. Well, I guess they already have Bluetooth versions of the Beats headphones, but updated Beats headphones to kind of go along with the iPhone 7. And then the last rumor around the iPhone 7 is that it may come with wireless charging. I'm a little bit mixed on this one because it makes sense. Apple has wireless charging that they've developed with the Apple Watch, and it seems like the next sort of step. But I never got the whole thing on wireless charging or what the advantage is. I guess if you're going to be, maybe it solves the problem. I think I just answered my own question. It sort of solves the problem that I was mentioning earlier about being able to have headphones plugged in and be able to charge at the same time, right? If you have headphones plugged into the lightning connector, you just click on your magnetic, dock connector for wireless charging and away you go. I would imagine the charger would be somewhat similar to what we see on the Apple Watch. So I don't know. How do you feel about wireless charging? Just seems like you still have to have it plugged in more or less. It's just you don't have a physical thing that a connector that inserts into a little hole on your device. But wireless charging, last thing with the iPhone 7. And iPhone 7 we're expected to see sometime in the fall, September timeframe, in case you're wondering about that. Now, something that's coming a little bit sooner, or rumored to be coming a little bit sooner, and we've been talking about for a while now too, is the iPhone 6C. So this would be the 4-inch version of the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. Most rumors are pointing to it having an Apple A9 processor and 2 gigabytes of RAM. So pretty much the same internal specs in terms of processor and RAM as the iPhone 6S. It would have Touch ID, but no 3D Touch. So that would be a differentiator between the lower end of the iPhone line and the current iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. I think that makes a lot of sense. And it would be priced similar to the current iPhone 5S. So basically a replacement of the iPhone 5S, newer updated version, and it would be possibly announced in March and then available April, sometime in that time frame. And I think this makes a lot of sense. I think there is demand for a lower priced iPhone, but people want to have the latest and greatest thing. And we are hearing some rumors of some slowing iPhone sales. We're going to talk about that more in a little bit. And this would be a nice way to sort of bump those sales back up, get some people converted over into the iPhone ecosystem. I think traditionally the 4-inch version of the iPhone has done very well with switchers, people coming over from Android. So they can walk into a store and get the latest and greatest iPhone in the same name, you know, naming scheme as the current iPhone. So it doesn't feel like you're getting the last generation device. And internally, you really aren't. You're getting the latest and greatest technology. So I'm pretty excited about the iPhone 6C. The other thing we're hearing is that it would have colors and that it would be in a metal casing. And I think the colors would be anodized aluminum, although we are hearing just two or three color choices are probably going to be what's going to be available. So I would still think it would be in that brighter color range, but it's unclear at this point. It could just be, you know, silver and space gray, or silver, space gray and gold. And we're going to have to wait maybe till March to find out about that. The other thing we're hearing about in that March timeframe is the Apple Watch 2. It's expected Apple will have a March announcement with an April ship date of the next generation of the Apple Watch. That's pretty much in line with releasing it, you know, in the same time frame as the original Apple Watch. What would be on it? Speculation is possibly more sensors. We had heard, remember way back when the Apple Watch is coming out, that it might have more, just more, it might have more than just a heart rate sensor, possibly skin kind of conductivity sensors, blood oxygen level sensors, blood pressure sensors. So expect it to do more. FaceTime camera is another thing that's rumored to possibly be built in. I'm not sure, so sure how I feel about a camera on a watch. Is that going to be really useful? Do people want to take selfies with their watch? Maybe they do. Some of the Android watches have a camera built in. I guess if you could do video chatting, it turns it more, even more Dick Tracy-like. So it's just a fun addition. I don't know if it's a big selling point to me. Also, a thinner design. Again, I worry about when things get thinner, what's going to happen with battery life. Apple Watch is already kind of on that edge of where the battery life maybe needs to be. So hopefully they can have improved battery life. Other things we've been hearing about, upgraded Wi-Fi technologies. I think some people would really like to see cellular data options for the Apple Watch, so they become a little bit more autonomous, separated from the iPhone. It's unclear if that would happen with the Apple Watch 2. GPS is another thing that a lot of people really want. But I think with cellular and GPS, again, you have to be really concerned about battery life. I don't think Apple is likely to add those things in, at least at this point. So we'll have to wait and see. But Apple Watch 2 rumors are out there. And then finally, the last thing we're hearing about is updated iPad Air, the iPad Air 3. This would be coming possibly in the spring because Apple didn't do the iPad Air update in the fall. They went with the iPad Pro. And it's expected that we should see an Apple iPad Air update in the first half of this year sometime. Whether or not it would happen with the iPhone 6C Apple Watch announcement, it's not clear at this point. Specs would basically be updated to bring it in line with the latest iOS devices, updated processors, cameras, RAM, all of that stuff. A lot of people want to see an iPad with 3D touch, although it's sounding from most of the rumors like the iPad Air 3 would not get 3D touch technology. It's been said by some analysts and some people looking into this stuff that Apple's been struggling kind of upscaling 3D touch for larger screens. So we're going to have to wait and see. But if you've been holding off, you've been waiting for that next generation 9.7-inch iPad, it probably should happen sometime in the first half of this year. If you heard the last episode, you know that something that is concerning analysts recently with regards to the iPhone is what's happening in terms of inventory and more specifically production of iPhones. They're noting in the channel and the supply chain that it seems like Apple is slowing down production of the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. And we've heard this report from a couple different analysts. This week, again, we've got further evidence from a Japanese site, Nikkei, and they say that Apple has too much excess iPhone 6S and 6S Plus inventory already in stores, and that they are seeing them slow down production. I kind of have mixed feelings about these reports because I think there's more to it than just what people are seeing in the supply chain. And I know I bring this up every time, but it's important to remind everybody that Tim Cook has historically said, looking at what's happening in the supply chain is not always the best or accurate indicator of what's going on with Apple's business. This time of year, Apple does normally slow down iPhone production a little bit because They ramp it up moving into the holiday quarter. They're going to post big holiday numbers. We've got their quarterly results call coming up here pretty soon. And then they need to kind of taper off because they've got stuff in channel. They've got enough inventory going, and they're just making this adjustment. But what's happening this time around, at least according to Nikkei, is these cuts seem to be higher than they have been in the past, as high as 30%. And that's getting everybody a little bit nervous. Another thing that they're saying that's factoring into iPhone sales not being as strong as they have in the past is the strong dollar. It's especially impacting emerging markets like India and China, although I guess not China, not quite as much. And that is different than a little bit than what we've seen in past years. And so the production slowdown is really seen as a correction for now. And the question is, how big is it? And is it different than what Apple has done in the past? And it's really spooking investors. It's spooking Wall Street a little bit. If you've been watching Apple's stock price this week, you know that you've seen the effect of what's going on. But it is expected that this will balance out. Apple's doing this adjustment. And then in the April-June quarters, everything should be back ramped up again. And if Apple does announce the rumored iPhone 6C, I think that's also going to bring this stuff back into play. So I'm not super concerned about it, but some people are. And in the short term, the cuts do seem to be impacting some of Apple's suppliers, because there were additional reports from companies like TPK Holdings, who makes touch panels for Apple, and their chassis supplier for iPhones, Catcher. They are both lowering their revenue estimates for this quarter, and they're both citing reduced client orders for the reason for the cutbacks. And, you know, they're not going to come out and name the company, but it's not too hard to draw the conclusion, and a lot of analysts believe that it is Apple that's doing the cutbacks for these guys. Even still, though, you know, analysts like Gene Munster think that Apple is going to be able to meet its iPhone guidance during their quarterly sales call for this quarter. That happens on January 26th. What's really going to be interesting is to see how the numbers are in, you know, for the first quarter of 2016, which I think is actually Apple's second financial quarter. But Munster expects Apple will still announce good year-over-year growth for the iPhone, and he's projecting revenue between $7.5 billion and $77.5 billion, with gross margins between 30 and 40%, which is typical for Apple, and those are going to be good numbers at that sales call. And at that point, it's probably, you know, the stock is probably going to readjust again. So this is just typical stuff that goes on this time of year, although maybe a little bit more extreme than in years past. And we're going to have to wait for that conference call on January 26th to see what the real numbers for this quarter are. But I don't think we need to be in a panic. We've, you know, started to get the typical, oh, Apple is doomed, they're on the downslide again sort of reports. But I think it's still a little bit too early to make that call. Really what's going to be important, I think, for Apple is what those second quarter numbers are going to look like. And at this point, it's kind of just a lot of speculation, and that's what we're seeing happening in the media right now. If you are a fan of buying your iPhone on a subsidized contract, you're probably not going to like this story too much, because both AT&T and Sprint this week looks like they are moving to kill off subsidized contracts for smartphones, including the iPhone. So this may make you happy if you hate carrier contracts, or it might make you sad if that's your preferred way for buying an iPhone. But Verizon and T-Mobile had already moved down this path of killing off contracts, and it's sounding like AT&T and Sprint are going to be following suit. First, we had Engadget. They claimed to get a hold of a leaked internal AT&T document that says after January 8th, actually the date that I'm recording this show, there will no longer be, AT&T will no longer be offering subsidized phones, including iPhones. You will have the option to either buy your device outright or to use one of the AT&T Next plans, which is, they're sort of, a lot of people call it like an interest-free payment plan. It's really like a, it's almost, in my mind, it's almost like a lease, but you do own your phone at the end of making the payments. So you're just making payments over time rather than getting a full subsidy up front and then paying back slowly over time through, payments made on top of your contract. So I like the new method a little bit better because it shows you there right in your bill, hey, you're going to be paying $30, $40 a month on top of your data plan and all your other items for this phone. And you can get it subsidized, or not subsidized, you can get the payments, the AT&T Next payments, paid out over, you know, different time frames. So if you want to do 12 months or 16 months or 18 months, or I forget all the different options, but I really think it's a better way to go. And as a matter of fact, Apple stopped offering subsidized phones in their retail stores when they launched their own version of this kind of payment plan and with the iPhone 6 and 6S Plus. And you remember we talked about that a lot. So if you're, you know, a big fan of the subsidies, AT&T is no longer going to be offering them. Another thing to note about this is if you're on a grandfathered unlimited plan, this could impact you a little bit if you don't want to pay the additional $5 a month to keep your unlimited plan. Because now if you're on a subsidy currently and you have the grandfathered AT&T unlimited, you are going to have to either pay the additional $5 a month because they're raising the price of those plans, which they haven't done since, you know, the iPhone originally came out. So I understand why they're doing that. But if you want to change your plans, you're not going to be able to go to another subsidized plan. So you're going to have to move to an AT&T Next plan, and that may or may not be what you want to do, but just something to be aware of. Another thing with AT&T real quickly is they also started rolling out limited availability of cross-carrier voice over LTE. So you might be using voice over Wi-Fi or voice over LTE technology just within the AT&T network when you call from AT&T phone to AT&T phone. Now they're going to start enabling that to go cross-carrier. So they haven't said who the other carrier is that they're working with, and it's currently only available in limited areas, but voice over LTE gives you a little bit better audio quality for your calls. So your calls might sound a little bit better to some people on some other unnamed carrier if you're in the right area. So could that be, maybe that story couldn't be a little bit more vague, but hey, just wanted to let you know that's going on. Now, getting back to the killing off contracts, since this party is growing, it looks like Sprint wants to get in on the action too. And there's a leaked memo from them as well, showing that they are ending their 2-year pricing options. They're going to do no more subsidies, and they are now just going to offer the lease or easy pay options on Sprint when you buy a new phone. So there you have it. This is the end of contracts. And it's probably not big news for anybody outside the U.S. because most countries beyond the United States don't really do the carrier subsidies and never really did. So we all have to get used to a new way of buying iPhones. And this is going to be it. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this week is the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas, CES 2016. And so far, I haven't seen very many individual showstoppers, anything that made me stop and go, oh, wow, I need to have that for my Mac. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on, specifically with like virtual reality technologies and drones and all that fun stuff. But anything specifically Mac related, not a whole lot of stuff. Other than the one thing I am excited about is a lot of USB-C products and devices are showing up on the market. And if you remember this year, Apple with the MacBook went to a single USB-C port. And I really feel moving forward that Apple is going to only put a Lightning port and USB-C ports on Macs moving forward. It would not surprise me if we saw them get rid of other kinds of ports and connections on MacBooks and MacBook Pros and Macs and Mac Pros moving forward. So USB-C, I think, is going to be a big new technology. And it's nice to see that we're getting some accessories available ahead of Apple actually making those changes, other than with, of course, the MacBook model. And so it's pretty exciting. We saw some monitors from Lenovo, including a 24-inch model that has multiple ways to connect and a 27-inch model that just offers a single USB-C cable but carries power and charging to your device. So you dock in and you get not only your video but also charging right through the monitor, all with a single cable. And that's one of the kind of advantages of USB-C is it can kind of be this docking cable that provides everything that you need. Acer also announced a cool lineup of USB-C supported monitors, and Asus jumped in with a 15.6 inch 1080p portable display that gets power and signal just through the USB-C cable. It weighs 1.8 pounds, and it's kind of cool because now you have a 15-inch secondary monitor that you could use with your MacBook and possibly future MacBook Pros. So I thought that was pretty neat. Griffin announced their own take on a MagSafe connector with a USB-C connector called BreakSafe. It's a USB-C power cable, and then it has a little magnetic connector on the other end. You would plug that into your USB-C port on your Mac, and then you just have a magnetic connection for the power cable. The only disadvantage I see on that is it does stick out a little bit, so it's not like, you know, MagSafe is on current MacBook Pros where it's nice and flush. You do have this little thing sticking out, but it's not too bad, and I think you could get away with it. I don't think it's going to damage the port if it gets bumped or anything like that. Seems pretty safe, and that was pretty neat to see. And then LaCie announced both mobile and desktop updates to their Porsche design hard drive lines. So they have USB-C connectors. They come in 1, 2, and 4 terabyte sizes for the mobile drives, and 4, 5, and 8 terabyte sizes for the desktop. And then there were a bunch of companies that announced USB-C docking solutions in all kinds of different flavors. So I think USB-C is going to be a big thing for Apple moving forward. And again, it's nice to see the accessories kind of coming out ahead of time. Now, Apple is not at CES. They don't go there to present, and there hasn't been any kind of huge, I think, disruption from Apple in terms of an announcement that's offsetting anything that's going on at CES. But there still is an Apple presence at CES, mostly being felt in the form of CarPlay. This year so far, CarPlay seems to be getting a lot of buzz, and it's a mix of seemingly good and bad news. What's interesting is the good and bad news, in a way, is kind of coming from the same source. So the first big announcement we heard was that Ford was saying that they're adding CarPlay and Android Auto to all of their 2017 model year vehicles in North America. So those are the ones that are coming out right now, the ones that are equipped with their BlackBerry QNX-based Sync 3 platform. So if they have Sync 3, they're going to be supporting CarPlay and Android Auto. So that was a big announcement. They also said that the 2016 models that have a Sync 3 system are going to get an upgrade later this year to add CarPlay and Android Auto support. So if you own a Ford that you bought in 2016, it has a Sync 3 system, it's sounding like you're going to be able to get CarPlay on your car at some point this year. And so that's huge, right? All of Ford 2016, 2017 models with Sync are going to have CarPlay technology. And then Fiat Chrysler also announced that they're going to add CarPlay support to what they said was a select number of vehicles this year. They did not give specifics, but said that cars with their Uconnect systems and 8.4-inch screens, along with a select number of other cars, would be supported with CarPlay. So you got Chrysler, Fiat, and you've got Ford, you know, pretty much rolling out broad support for CarPlay in 2016. And so that was the good news. And then you had the bad news, which was Toyota, who came out and said that they're moving forward on their stated intention to dump CarPlay. They're getting rid of it in favor of their own technologies. And it's unfortunate because they were one of the early supporters of CarPlay, but last year announced that they would not adopt the technology. And what they're doing instead is they said that they are going to use Ford's smart device link technology. Yep. So Ford, the company that says, hey, we're going to have broad support for CarPlay, Toyota is going to be taking on their smart device link technology, which is not a CarPlay technology. It's more of a, seems like somewhat of a CarPlay competitor. Although when I looked into it, the way it's described is some smart device link is an open source version of Ford's App Link platform for smartphone apps. And basically what it does is it allows customers to use apps in their vehicle through the voice recognition functionality and through the in-dash display, but basically running the apps on their devices. So it sounds like an app developer would build the smart link or smart device link technology into their app, and then it would be able to talk and communicate with the in-dash display. A little bit more like Siri's Eyes Free integration or app integration to me, where you can voice control the app through your head unit, but it's not really a tight integration. I'm not really sure. If you happen to know a little bit more about App Link and Smart Device Link, let me know. But really sounding like developers would build this into their apps and then it would be supported. So in a way, it would still support iOS devices. I would assume any iOS app that has this Ford Smart Device Link technology built into it would work with your Toyota. It's just you're not going to get Apple's CarPlay interface up on your in-dash display. So not a huge downer, but it would be nice if Toyota had not gone back on their CarPlay support. But it's sounding at this point that that's what it's going to be like. And, you know, the only other thing I'll say on CarPlay, and I don't have it in my system, I haven't been able to play with it, but based on feedback I get from you, it sounds like it's a technology that never really or still hasn't been quite the solution I think that we would all like to see in our vehicles. It's a nice integration. People tend to like it, but it sounds like it's still not fully polished and it's not that experience that people want to have. And I don't know if that's a function of Apple struggling with the CarPlay technology or if it's more in the implementation side. It's more of getting together with the car manufacturers and the partners and actually making that integration work the way it's supposed to. Apple's kind of had a lot of stumbling and roadblocks, I think, in getting CarPlay technology fully integrated. But hopefully with some of these announcements at CES, at least with Ford and Chrysler vehicles, some of those bumps are going to get a little bit smoothed out. So it'll be interesting to see how this year's models do with their CarPlay integration. And I look forward to kind of seeing how it works out and also to maybe getting some feedback from some of you who have CarPlay in your vehicles or if you buy a new vehicle this year comes with CarPlay. It'd be great to get some feedback and let me know what you think about it. And if you have the current system, how are you liking it? How does it work? Is it great? Is it frustrating? Send me some feedback, mattcast@gmail.com. Now, I know we've talked about the Apple Pencil when it came out. iFixit did their teardown, and it is an amazing bit of technology. I think we went over the fact that it has this cool folded logic board in it. And there's not a lot to this next story, but what is in here, I think, is just purely awesome. You know, for me, the Apple Pencil, I guess part of the reason why I'm excited about this is the Apple Pencil is an accessory that really completes the iPad Pro experience for me. I absolutely love it. I know they're still hard to come by. If you have an iPad Pro and you don't have a pencil, I use mine for drawing, for writing. I've even started to use it in a lot of cases just for tapping around on the screen, almost using it as an extension or enhancement to the 10 styluses that I have built into my hand. Because of the size of the iPad Pro, I find a lot of times, especially if I have it on a desk or on a table or something like that, I'll have it pushed a little further back. And I'll just take the pencil out of my pocket and use it to browse around the screen. And it's a nice little extension of your finger. But the tech inside of it is the stuff that really makes it work. It gives it its magic. And the Chipworks, the guys who do a lot of the X-ray kind of analysis of tech products, they did an extensive analysis of the Apple Pencil, and they found more than 15 semiconductors inside this thing. And it's amazing because the Apple Pencil is just 176 millimeters long. It's 9 millimeters thick, and that's an impressive amount of technology. They found that most of the chips were from Texas Instruments and STM Microelectronics, but there's also chips in there from Maxim Integrated Products, Cambridge Silicon Radio, Silicon Time, I guess it's SI, the atomic symbol for silicone, SiTime, Bosch, Fairchild. I mean, it's just packed with circuits, with integrated chips. And even more amazing is that there's a chip in the actual tip of the Apple Pencil. I thought it was just, you know, like a capacitive thing. It's actually replaceable because I think it'll wear out over time. Apple gives you an extra one when you buy the Apple Pencil in the packaging. But inside that is a tiny little driver integrated circuit made by STM, ST Microelectronics. And it's in there. It's just totally, totally amazing. And you have to remember, too, packed inside that is also the battery, which is 3.82 volts, I think 0.329 milliwatt hours. So you got to have that inside there as well. And it's all packed in this tiny little amazing package that you have all this tech and it just completely fades away when you're using it. It's just like using a natural pencil on paper, what have you. There's a lot of great apps that are coming out for it. Some of the apps that I have been using with it, some of my favorites, Paper by 53, of course, Procreate, Adobe Sketch, the new coloring book app, Pigment, which is a ton of fun, really great application, Notability for taking notes. Just the Notes app is amazing, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit later. So just a lot of fun. Again, if you don't have an Apple Pencil for your iPad Pro, I encourage you head into an Apple store. They have them on display. Check them out. I absolutely love mine. If you do anything with drawing, note-taking, and you have an iPad Pro, I think it is a must-have accessory. It's well worth the $100 that Apple asks for it. If you can find one. I guess they're still hard to come by. But good luck getting one if you don't have one yet. And then finally, in the news for today, I have actually kind of a sad story because a long-standing Mac app and a great developer has apparently left our community. These guys have been an early sponsor of the MacCast, but I've loved them for years. They do a great application called Notebook. The company is Circus Ponies, of course. And Jason Adams, who is the developer at Circus Ponies, announced this week that he is ending development on the product after 13 years on the Mac. And on his site, he wrote, "After 13 years in business, Circus Ponies has gone to that great alphabet company in the sky. It was a good run, but we are done, as in no longer in business." And if you go to the website now, that's what's up there. The product actually, for history's sake, began as a Next application, believe it or not, way back in the 90s. And I read this into it. Jason didn't really think this was going to happen, but he has the alphabet reference in there. And many of you probably know that Alphabet is the name of the new parent company for Google, for a lot of the Google projects. And they use this .xyz domain, and in the press release, Jason links to circusponies.xyz and has Circus Ponies as the C. And some sites speculated, and I thought this myself, that Circus Ponies maybe had been acquired, or Notebook rather, maybe had been acquired by Google. Google acquires companies all the time. And that's not the case. Jason told the Mac Observer that while he was flattered that people believed the app was good enough to be picked up by Google, it's not what's happening. Another theory being thrown around is that Jason has taken a position at Google, that maybe he ended up being a developer at Google, got a job there, but there's no confirmation or evidence of that either so far. If that changes, I will let you know. But, my guess is that, unfortunately, some of my fears about the future of app development and the Mac and iOS, and we've talked about this on the show, some of those fears are coming true. And this is a little bit of evidence of that. It is getting harder and harder with the new app ecosystem, I think, to be a independent developer, to be a true indie developer. Jason in 2010 ported Notebook to the iPad. It received very mixed reviews. He was very ambitious with the product in terms of trying to bring all the functionality from the desktop onto iOS, and struggled a little bit with that. And I think Notebook kind of took a hit a little bit for that. Again, this is just my own speculation. I haven't been able to talk to Jason at all. Hopefully I can maybe get a hold of him at some point, and maybe we can even get him on the show to talk about what's going on. I'm purely speculating at this point, but the fact that a lot of apps are going very low cost or free on iOS, and we're seeing this race to the bottom kind of pricing happening over there. You've got free solutions showing up to compete with indie developers from Apple. I mean, the new Notes application is a very capable note-taking application. You've got Microsoft, Evernote, a lot of other big companies in the same space, and it makes it very hard for an indie developer to survive, especially when pricing becomes so sensitive. And it's really, I think, a sad state of affairs, but likely we're going to see a lot more of this. I don't think this is the end of this sort of thing, unfortunately. And I'm really saddened by the news, but I wish Jason the best of luck wherever he goes or whatever he does next. Hopefully he's not totally leaving development because he's a brilliant guy. He created a great, amazing piece of software and was an integral part of this community for the past 13 years. So hopefully his talents are lost. If they ended up at Google, great for them. If they end up somewhere else, even better, especially if he's continuing to develop for the Mac and iOS. And again, wish him the best of luck. And hopefully we don't see too many more of our great indie developers in this community fall. But if they do, I understand the pressures and I understand what's going on. It makes a lot of sense that this sort of thing can happen, as much as I don't like to think about it too much. But anyway, a little bit of sad news for our community as Notebook leaves and Circus Pony shuts down. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, I need to make a little bit of an apology because it looks like I stepped in it again. It happens from time to time, and whenever I do, I'm willing to fully make apologies, a little mea culpa if I need to. Last week, I mentioned that a listener had told me he was told by an Apple genius to remove the wheel user, and I thought this meant the wheel group, from his Mac. And if you don't know what all that means, go back and listen to the last episode of the MacCast, because fortunately, it was a good opportunity for me to talk about the Unix underpinnings of Mac OS X and the multi-user platform and permissions and the different kinds of groups and security a little bit more, just to bring that out into the open for people who don't tend to get that technical about what's under the hood in OS X. But needless to say, the wheel group is a very important part of the operating system and isn't something that should be removed. And when I received this email from this listener, it was my understanding that that was what was going on. Well, it turns out he emailed me after hearing the episode, said, no, I think you got it a little bit wrong. That really wasn't the case. What I had was actually a user in the user group system preferences called Wheel. It was actually set up as a user account. And he has no idea how it got in there, doesn't know why it was there. And he actually deleted that user, removed it himself before going to the Genius Bar. So it was all done in advance. The Genius did not give him that recommendation. So I was mistaken on that. So I just wanted to clear that up. It does, though, bring back this mystery, which was one of the original questions he was asking me about. And unfortunately, I misunderstood the question. How did the wheel user get into his system at all? What could have possibly happened to have caused that? And I have no idea. I've never heard of an app or anything creating a user account called Wheel on a Mac. And as a matter of fact, I haven't even heard of too many ways for a mysterious user account to get created unless it's specifically by an admin on that system, somebody that has physical access. So if for some odd reason you know why or how this may have happened, if you have any clues, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. But I guess it also somewhat serves as a reminder. You might want to just do a quick check on your own system. Look in the system preferences, look in the user accounts, and make sure that you only have the ones there that you think are supposed to be there. And, maybe there's malware or adware or something out there that is injecting user accounts, fake user accounts into OS X. And if you do know about something like that, again, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Notes because I received a couple of emails this past week from users who have been having trouble syncing notes via iCloud. And I'm talking about the Notes app in OS X and iOS. And specifically, they're having troubles with older systems. So not OS X El Capitan, but OS X Yosemite and OS X Mavericks. They've got note syncing on. They're using iCloud.com and iCloud syncing, and they're on iOS 9. And the minute they told me, oh, we're using iOS 9 and our notes aren't syncing and we're on older operating systems on the Mac, I knew exactly what was going on. But you may not be aware of this, so I thought I'd point this out. What has happened is in OS 10 Yosemite, or with the launch of OS 9 and OS 10 El Capitan, rather, Apple completely changed how note syncing works. So prior to iOS 9, the way that notes would sync is it was part of actually the mail platform of the IMAP, Internet Mail Application Protocol, the IMAP piece, and it was baked into the mail application. And even though they had separated it, and I think if you remember a couple versions of the OS back, notes were actually part of mail. And then they broke it out into the notes application, but they were still using the mail part of it for syncing. That changed when Apple updated to iOS 9 and then later to OS 10 El Capitan. So if you update to iOS 9, the first time you launch the notes application, I think it is, or the first time you enable note syncing, I don't remember at what point it pops up, but it will pop up a warning and say, look, notes syncing has changed. If you migrate now, you may no longer be able to sync notes on your Mac. And there was actually a two-week period where iOS 9 was out, but OS 10 El Capitan was not. And so the warning was put in there because of that discrepancy. It was like, if you migrate your notes to the new version, you're not going to have syncing on the Mac. And really, the only workaround to getting notes to sync on a pre-OS 10 El Capitan Mac is to use notes through the web interface on iCloud.com. So it will still sync to iCloud.com, but then you're going to have to manage and read and add notes on your Mac from the web interface. If you do it in the Notes application and you're running OS 10 Yosemite or OS 10 Mavericks, it is not going to sync back to iOS 9. Now, if you're pre-iOS 9, you should still be fine. The old system should still work. But if you've upgraded, that's when you run into this problem. So if you do upgrade, though, let's talk about that. Because actually, if you can upgrade to El Capitan and iOS 9, there's some great new benefits in the Notes application. A couple of great new features that are really good and really bring the Notes application more in par with something like OneNote or Evernote. Things like the ability to turn a list into an interactive checklist, or to add a photo or a map or a URL to a note and actually get active data and image previews and clickable links and information right inside the Notes app. So you can preview a map or you can preview an image without even having to open an external application. They also have the sketching tools. So now you can sketch in Notes on iOS. And if you have an iPad Pro and an Apple Pencil, you can even use the Apple Pencil and get pressure sensitivity and all that stuff. But even if you don't have an iPad Pro and an Apple Pencil, on iOS 9 with the Notes app, you can draw sketches with your finger on your iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch. So to use the sketching features in iOS 9 in Notes, you open up a new note, and then down in the lower right-hand corner, there's a little plus symbol, and you tap on that, and that will give you access to a lot of the new tools. And one of those is a little squiggly line icon that you'll see. If you tap on that, that turns on the drawing tools, and you'll be given a bunch of different ones. You have a pen, a marker, a pencil, a ruler, and an eraser. And so you can pick any one of those, pen or the pencil, start drawing. The marker actually kind of has transparency, so as you go over it, you know, you'll see the marker over top of other elements. So if you write in pen, you can use the marker almost as a highlighter. There's a little color picker, so you can swipe to pick a bunch of from a bunch of different colors. There's a couple different palettes, although you do not have the ability to create any custom colors. You're kind of confined to the ones that Apple has predefined. The ruler is kind of a neat tool because when you activate that, it puts this ruler on the screen and then any line you draw down the side of the ruler will be totally straight. And you can rotate it with two fingers, and as you rotate, it'll even display the angle in degrees right there on the screen. So if you need to draw a 45 or a 30, you can get the exact angle that you're looking for. And as you draw, I noticed it's somewhat hard to see. It does list what I think is a distance in, I'm guessing, pixels. It doesn't look like inches. It actually looks like the number of pixels that you've drawn. So if you're trying to draw very precise or lines that are exactly the same length, that might even come in a little bit handy, although I think it's a little bit hard to use. So drawing tools, sketching tools are in there. You also have formatting tools. So again, when you tap that little plus icon, there's an icon that is two letter A's, an uppercase and a lowercase. If you tap on that, it will give you options for heading, title, body, bulleted lists, dashed lists, numbered lists, so you can apply formatting. The checklist option is also under that little plus icon. So there's a little checkmark icon. And as you add new items, it'll actually create checkable checklists. You can even select an existing bulleted, dashed, or numbered list and then tap the checkmark icon with that selection, and it will convert your selection into a checklist very quickly. And then to add things like URLs or add a photo from the Photos app or Maps, you actually do that from the individual application. So open up the appropriate app, Safari, Photos, Maps, and then if you click on the little share button, there is an option to select add to notes. And when you do that, it'll give you a little preview and then let you choose either a new note or an existing note to add that information into. And then once it's inside the notes, like I said, if it's a photo, you can do a little preview of it. If it's a Safari link, it'll give you a preview and some additional information. The map, you can preview the map right inside the notes. And all of that will sync between your iOS devices and your Mac. Again, if you're running iOS 9 and OS 10 El Capitan. And it's pretty cool. I mean, it's a pretty full-featured notes application. Now, if you find that you're needing a little bit more than that, or if maybe you're looking for an alternative to Circus Pony's Notebook, if you've been using that for a few years. And Circus Pony's Notebook, by the way, will still work. It's still working in OS 10, in OS 10 El Capitan, as far as I know. It's just you're not going to be getting any more updates, obviously, because Jason has decided to retire the product. But if you're looking for alternative note applications, and I'm just listing a few off for you to take a look at, I don't really have any judgments on any of them. You have Evernote and OneNote. Also Omni Outliner, which really that one, it's my favorite application, but I really do outlining for most of my notes. So that's the one I like to use. It's not going to have some of the same features as Evernote or OneNote, in terms of, you know, adding in some of the clippings and things like that. It does have support for that, but it's just not quite the same. And then if you prefer just taking notes as text or using Markdown, one of my favorite applications for that is Byword, and that's really just a text editor with Markdown support and formatting. So you can check those out as possible alternatives to Circus Ponies, or if you're just looking for a good note-taking application. I think it's safe to say that messages and text messaging have become a pretty important form of communication for most people. I think most of us use iMessages, messages, text messages. It could be Twitter. I don't care what form of sort of text messaging you use, but it's pretty commonplace in our society now. And a lot of us probably really rely on that message history for certain bits of information. As organized as a lot of us like to think we are, or try to be, some people are. I'm not in that group. I'm the first to admit. A lot of us use either the message history or email or these different things to kind of keep track of certain bits of information. And unfortunately, if you've ever used the Messages app on iOS, it can be somewhat difficult to go back and find that information. So we probably all do need a better system of, like, you know, throwing it into, I don't know. I try to throw reminders into something like OmniFocus, but I'm very bad at keeping track of that stuff or moving it into some other platform. And I think, you know, when James sent me this question, he was kind of in the same boat, right? You have some information in there. You need to go find it. You go to look for it. And lo and behold, it's difficult to find. So Here was the question that James sent me this week.
Hey, Adam. It's James here up in Port Alberni, BC, Canada. Long-time listener. Anyway, I have a question for you regarding searching text messages on the iPhone. I recently got an iPhone 6S a couple months ago, and I was trying to find a text message from a client who had sent that message to me maybe about 2-3 months ago. And it came in as a regular text message, so it was a green little bubble. Anyway, I noticed that I wasn't able to find the message using Spotlight on the phone. It couldn't find the message. However, when I manually went through iMessage, I was able to find the message. And I found this problem also with iMessage. Now, if the message was maybe a couple weeks or maybe even a month old, Spotlight had no problems finding the message. I'm just wondering if this has something to do with the service being put into the cloud through the iMessage system, and the phone, or I should say the messages, aren't no longer stored on the actual iPhone but in the cloud, and that's the reason why I'm not able to go that far back. So my question to you is there a way around this? If I disable iMessage, will that fix my problem in terms of going back 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, a year, or what have you? Anyway, thanks so much for your show. Talk to you later.
Hey, thanks, James. Appreciate the question. Yeah, you hit a little bit of a problem, I think, with just the Messages app. I don't think it really has anything to do, at least based on the research that I've done, with whether or not it's an SMS message, you know, a standard text message, or a iMessage. What it comes down to is it looks like really messages are only searchable for the last month of messages, but the data still seems to be there on the phone. And let me back up a little bit for people who are wondering about just how you search for messages on iOS. I know for most of us it seems pretty obvious, but just want to point out there are really kind of two methods for searching for messages. And it looks like, James, or it sounds like, James, that you were using Spotlight to do your at least initial search when you discovered this problem and were noticing, hey, there's only about, it's only searching about a month back in my Messages app. Spotlight is the thing that you activate either by swiping all the way over to the left from the home screen or swiping down on the home screen in iOS 9. And the way that you can make sure that messages are even available to search on Spotlight, because you do have the option to turn different Spotlight searches on or off, is through the settings. So if you go into Settings, General, and then Spotlight Search, you'll notice you can scroll through all of the applications on your Mac and make them available to a Spotlight search. Now, I believe Messages is checked on by default, but just in case someone is searching for messages and they're not finding any results, go in Spotlight Search and make sure that you do have messages checked on. And unfortunately, it used to be that you could actually control the order of which applications showed up in Spotlight. So when you do a Spotlight search, you know what comes up more toward the top. You don't seem to have that ability anymore, which really frustrates me a lot, because I'd like to prioritize like maybe emails followed by text messages followed by, you know, various other things. You can't really do that anymore. So messages usually show up more toward, at least for me, the bottom of the Spotlight search. So you have to scroll down a little bit to actually even see the results, which is a little bit frustrating. But again, you're only going to see messages from about the last month or so. Now, the other way to search for messages is within the Messages app itself. And even there, finding the search box isn't that obvious. If you open up Messages and you're seeing your message history, you know, the list of all of the ongoing conversations and threads that you have going on, what you need to do is you need to swipe down on that list, and then you will see the little search box. And you can type a search in there, but once again, it only goes back about a month. And that is a real bummer, because even if you have older data in there, and a lot of us do, you might have text messages in a thread that go back several months. Those are not going to be searchable. Now, you can go into that individual thread and start to scroll back. And if you scroll back about a month, it seems to me like what it does is it then loads the next month of data. So it's like the data is there, and I don't think it's pulling it down from the cloud, James. I know that was part of your question. I really don't think that's stored in the cloud. It could be, but what is making me think that it's not, and what is a little bit baffling, is that the way I found that you could work around possibly being able to search further back is to actually use an application like PhoneView from Ecamm or iMazing. These are little applications that will let you, when your phone is docked and attached with the Lightning to USB cable to your Mac, it will actually let you pull data from various parts of your phone. So you can back up things like photos, you can back up additional information, you can browse through your application data, all that sort of stuff. And one of the things that you can go back and browse through is your message history. And it looks like the way it does that is it actually pulls it from your backup files. So you know when you dock your phone to your Mac in iTunes, you can actually pull a backup. Well, if you pull that backup, all that messaging data is in there. And that's why it makes me think that the data is all there. It's just that on the iOS device, it's only showing about the last month of information. And I'm thinking that's a performance thing, but why it won't put that into the Spotlight Index, you know, the entire history, is really beyond me. And it's probably a question we'd have to ask an Apple engineer. And unfortunately, I don't have access to one of those people. But if you go in to use PhoneView or iMazing and you go into its messaging section, you can pull all the messages in and you can search them from there. And it works great. So why we can't do that on the iOS device is beyond me. Maybe there's a third-party app that I'm not aware of, so I'm going to throw it out to you in the community. Is there a way beyond just pulling the data onto our Mac with an application like PhoneView, is there a way on iOS to be able to search back more than a month of message history in the Messages app? And I really don't know, James. But in the meantime, either do the scroll back trick like you already did, or use one of these third-party apps. That's the workaround that I have for you. And hopefully someone from the community will have a little bit better solution for us. Or hopefully at some point, Apple will recognize that we want more of this data in our Spotlight search and just add it to the index. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard to do. Maybe it's a storage concern. I don't really know. But baffling, needless to say, and thank you for the question. Now I want to give you a little update on my iPad Pro experience. If you've been listening to the show, you know that since getting my iPad Pro, one thing that I wanted to do was to see if I could use my iPad Pro as my primary mobile computing platform. So for a long time, I've had an iPad and a MacBook Pro. I've carried both of them with me many times when I'm going mobile. So if I'm leaving the house, I'll take my iPad Pro and my MacBook Pro and my iPad with me. And since getting the iPad Pro, I was wondering, you know, with the keyboard and the pencil and all the accessories, could I have this be my primary machine? And so far, it's working great. I've been taking just my iPad Pro and I can do notes, I can do my research, I can answer emails, I can surf the web. I can do probably about 90% of the tasks that I typically do when I'm mobile. But there are some tasks that the iPad Pro just is not up to yet. And specifically, I'm a web developer. I do programming. And while there are some very capable apps for writing code on the iPad, things like Draft Code for PHP or Textastic, if I'm doing HTML or CSS coding, they have integrated FTP clients so I can work with my servers and stuff like that. The problem is that there really is no way to run and test code locally. So I typically run a full LAMP stack. That's, you know, Linux, Apache server, MySQL, PHP, basically a development environment locally on my Mac. And every website that I work on, I have a little local copy set up and I can just run it right there on my machine for doing testing and debugging and all these sorts of things. You really can't do that on an iPad. Now, something like Draft Code lets you even run PHP. It has a little version of PHP running in it. You can write actual PHP code and you can test it in the app, but it's limited and you don't have a lot of control over it. You also don't have a full MySQL database. You can do stuff with SQLite, but it's a little bit tricky and clunky and kludgy. And so that means that, you know, you really, your only option ends up being testing remotely. You could set up a test environment, say, on a server. So I have a web server. I can build out test environments there. It's typically not how I like to work. So I could completely change my workflow, and I've played around with that a little bit. You can do Amazon like EC3 or EC2. I think it's called EC2. Basically, Amazon will let you set up little, you know, development environments and things like that on their platform. And it's not too expensive, and you can spin up environments and do all this cool stuff. So there are some workarounds. There's a way to do that. And you have apps like Transmit on the iPad. But even with testing remotely, kind of getting your files from, say, draft code up to the server and around and stuff like that still is kludgy. You're still kind of shuffling files around, and it's not really ideal. And so what I've resolved myself to is probably the best workaround would be, I've got my MacBook Pro now sitting at home, right? Because I'm not taking it with me. Probably the best environment would be to set that Mac up as a remote access machine. So I've started to think about this a little bit and play around with it some, and it works pretty well. You can actually, with an iPad Pro, pull up a remote controlled Mac, and it's like having your Mac on your iPad. And if you have a good internet connection, the latency is not too bad. It's not too slow, and you can actually really get some real work done. And there's a couple ways to do this, and I thought I'd just go through some of the solutions in a really kind of high level overview way. We're not going to get down into the nitty gritty of actually how to do a lot of these configurations, but just to get your mind thinking about possible options. If you're thinking about using an iPad Pro as a mobile computing platform, this would be one way to kind of handle some of those edge cases. And so you could use an app like Log Me In, which is a great app. You run a little client, or I guess it's rather really kind of a server on your Mac, install a little application, and it basically makes your Mac available through remote access through the Log Me In service. And so you run the Log Me In client on your iPad Pro, and you can connect back to your Mac. And when you do that, you log in with your, your Mac credentials, and you basically see your screen on the iPad Pro. You've got the dock, you've got all your applications and things like that. And it works really well. The only disadvantage to using a service like that would really be there is a cost. LogMeIn costs about $150 a year. So you do have to pay a subscription fee, but the setup is super easy. I love LogMeIn. I've been using it for years. Now, if you don't want to pay for that, though, there are some built-in options in OS X and some apps on the iPad that you could kind of roll your own version of something like Log Me In. And I know there's other services that people like to use. If you have one that you really like and want to give a recommendation, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But I'm just going to talk about the things that I've used in the past and that I like. So the other thing that you could do is you could roll your own remote access to your Mac using VNC and SSH, which are both built into the Mac. SSH stands for Secure Shell, and it's just a way to access like a terminal window remotely from one machine to another across the internet. VNC is a remote control application. I always want to say it stands for Virtual Network Client, but I know there's a couple definitions for the acronym, and I often get it right. Virtual Network Computer, I think, is another thing that people say it means. Basically, it's a way to see a remote screen or a remote desktop from another system. And I'm oversimplifying, but again, if you've ever used Apple's built-in screen sharing application to control one Mac across your local network, basically the same thing. It uses VNC-like technology, or it might even use VNC technology under the hood. And again, I'm going to be covering these basic concepts, not a lot of details. All of the stuff that I'm going to be talking about is Googleable. Is that a word? Googleable? You can Google it once you know the kinds of things that you're looking for. So I'm just trying to give you the things that you're looking for, and then you can take it from there with your own research. Or maybe we'll even do a special deep dive at one point, but this could be a whole episode in and of itself. And there are also some serious considerations if you're thinking about setting this up, and things that you really should look into, again, that I'm not going to go into deep details about. And that is, you're going to need to have a Mac serving as a server that you're going to connect to to be able to do the remote access. So that needs to have high uptime and high availability. The machine needs to be on all the time. Can't really be going to sleep. So energy issues, battery backups, all those sorts of things. Security is another huge one. So for a lot of this stuff, you're going to have to open up ports on your firewall, and you need to think about security, or route ports through your router, IP addresses and IP access. So if you're using an internet service provider where your IP address changes, you're going to have to either get a static IP address so that your computer, you always know where it is on your network, or other things like that. And you're going to need to have a Mac that is dedicated for being the access point. So in my case, this is going to be my MacBook Pro, right? And so the basic overview of what you're going to need to do is you're going to need to set up VNC, the VNC service, and you're going to need to set up SSH or an SSH server on your Mac. Luckily, Apple makes this pretty easy to do. You're going to need to set up some security, and I would really recommend using SSH tunneling and SSH keys. So you're going to want to do an SSH private and public key. And again, if you Google this stuff, it will show you how to actually create these things. It's all built in on the Mac. It's not too difficult, but it, you know, does require getting into the terminal and configuring some things. So if that scares you off, think more about using a service like LogMeIn, which is going to handle a lot of the security and the setup for you. You're still going to have to deal with some of the port forwarding and those sorts of things. And then you are going to need to set up your router and your Mac to route the traffic from outside your network back to inside your network so that you can actually make the connection. And then you're going to need to set up and configure a client, some sort of software on your iOS device that will allow you to do the SSH tunnel and connect to your VNC server. Now, when you're setting up your Mac, one thing you're going to want to make sure is that you turn off any sleep functions in the system preferences energy saver. You don't want things going to sleep. You can have the monitor go to sleep, but generally you don't want the computer to go to sleep. I know they have the wake on LAN WAN or LAN request features, but sometimes those get in the way, and I've never had really good success with that. So I generally go into energy saver on any Mac that I'm going to set up for remote access and turn those kinds of features off. And then you're going to need to have a way to get back to your Mac. And that means typically your Mac is going to need to, or your, I shouldn't say your Mac, I should say your home network, your external IP address, which is typically the one that's assigned to your cable modem or your DSL router, your access point, that's going to need to have an IP address that never changes. Now, most ISPs, if you're using a cable company or a DSL company, they don't guarantee that you're always going to have the same IP address. So you're probably going to have to use a service, something like DynDNS, which has a remote access service, costs about $40 a year. And basically what it does is you run a little client application on your Mac, and anytime your outside IP address changes, it will let DynDNS know about that. And you can map a URL, and they have a bunch of different domains that you can use, to your internal IP address so that you will always have a URL that when you type it in, it will always be able to find its way back to your specific network that your Mac is on. So again, it's going to be the public IP address of your router, and then you're going to need to set up some port forwarding and some routes on the router itself so that it knows, okay, when I get traffic on this IP address, on this port, I know to send that traffic to the private IP address to this specific Mac that's on my network. So you'll do that with a combination of DynDNS and configuring your router. So if you use an airport, it's relatively easy to do. And again, you can Google it that. And when you're setting up the routing, you want to have the most secure kind of connection. You want to make sure that you're using non-standard ports, because a lot of hackers and folks know that SSH, secure shell, is a way to get into systems, and they will try and hack into that. And the SSH port is port 22, and it's a very common port. And so that's one that a lot of hackers will probe. They'll try and figure out, do they have SSH turned on, and they'll check that port. So you'll want to use some other port, some non-standard port on the outside of your router, and then route that traffic internally to the correct location. So to make this also most secure, you'll want to use SSH, secure shell, and you'll want to use a key pair, a public-private key pair, to do the authentication. You don't want to just use a simple password. Using a public-private key pair is the most secure way to go about this. Again, you can Google for how to set that up on your Mac. As far as turning on SSH or remote access on your Mac, turning on, you know, turning your Mac into an SSH server, that's relatively easy to do. You go into the system preferences, you go into the sharing options, and there is a sharing service called Remote Login. And you turn that on, you tell it what accounts you want to be able to access through SSH, and again, make sure that you set up the public-private key pair, and then in your client, that's how you're going to use that. That key is what you're going to use to do your authentication. So you're not going to actually have to enter a password and log in. You're going to use the public-private key pair to actually handle the login stuff. Now, for VNC or for remote access, the way you're going to turn that on is, again, you're going to go into system preferences, into sharing, and then you're going to turn on remote access in the sharing control panel, or I think it's called remote management rather. And then also in remote management, you want to click on the computer settings button and then turn on the VNC service. So there's a checkbox that says VNC viewers may control this screen with a password. Check that on, and then make sure you set up a very secure VNC password. And keep in mind, you're really going to want to set up VNC so that it's only running internally on your network. You're not going to have to open this up through your firewall or through the router. You're not going to do any routing of VNC traffic, because the idea here is what you're going to do is you're going to connect via secure shell, via SSH from the outside, to your internal network, and then you're going to pass your VNC traffic, your remote control access, through the SSH tunnel or through the SSH connection, which is called an SSH tunnel. So hopefully I'm kind of explaining that. Again, I know it's a little bit more technical, but do a little bit of research on your own. Figure this stuff out. It's really not that hard once you want to, you know, once you know you want to set it up, you can, there's some great tutorials and things online that you'll find. As far as setting up that SSH key pair, this is how you're going to be able to authenticate. There's lots of tutorials online on how to do it. I found a great one over on GitHub. I will link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. Essentially, what will happen is once you've generated the keys, you're going to copy your key into whatever client you're going to use on your iOS device, and it will use that to create the remote access through the SSH tunnel. Again, you'll have mapped the ports on your router so that you can go from the outside to the inside. One good recommendation I got from George Starcher is just make sure that places like Starbucks, they block a lot of outbound ports. So you might have to do a little bit of trial and error to figure out what non-standard port you can actually use when you're outside your home network at a place like Starbucks. So play around a little bit. I don't have exact numbers, but again, I would imagine you could probably do some Googling and search on that. You'll probably want to set up your Mac with a static internal IP address or use a DHCP reservation for the internal IP address on your Mac so you know that that never changes, because something that happens when you have your router set up, if you're just using a DHCP connection, every time you unplug or take your Mac off the network and put it back on, it could get a different IP address, which would then change any of the routing that you have set up on your router. So you need to know that your Mac is always going to have the same internal IP address, and that is never going to change. So either setting that up statically or using a DHCP reservation is going to help maintain that. And then another thing, if you want to be even more secure, about your SSH connection from the outside of your network into the inside of your network. I already mentioned using a non-standard SSH port on the outside. Another thing that George Starcher told me about and could even be better is if you have an extra machine, and he actually uses a Raspberry Pi for this, but if you have another computer that you can set up to act as a proxy server, so it would actually answer the SSH connection and then internally behind the scenes forward that traffic or make that connection over to your Mac so that you're actually not exposing your Mac to the outside world. And that's another really great way to go. So again, a little bit complicated, but certainly something that is doable with a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of searching. The last bit of this puzzle, of course, would be to install and configure a VNC client on your iOS device, preferably one that can handle the SSH tunneling. And most of them can. The application that I like to use on my iOS devices is called Screens. I will have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. And what is great about it is it allows you to enable a what they call a secure connection, which is basically the SSH tunnel part of it. So in Screens, when you're going to go set up your remote connection, you add a new connection, you set up the VNC stuff for your internal Mac, so you'll give it your Mac's local address and ports, and you'll set all that stuff up. And then you'll click on the little secure connection area, and that's where you'll copy in your SSH key, and you'll set up your authentication, and you'll plug in the DynDNS address for your Mac, and you'll set up the custom port number that you're going to use, the non-standard port number you're going to use for SSH. You'll configure all of that in the client application, and then test it. It has a little test button. Verify that you can make the connection, and once it's all successful, then you should be able to, from anywhere in the world, safely and securely, remotely connect and control your Mac. And that means on my iPad Pro now, when I'm out and about, if I want to do some programming, I can actually just remotely connect to my Mac back at home, fire up my standard tools, which I use Sublime Text for my code editing. I have access to Tower, which is my Git client for accessing my code repositories and checking in and out files, getting access to that information. And it feels like I have a Mac or OS X running on my iPad Pro. Again, if I have a good enough connection, occasionally there can be a little bit of a lag and it, you know, it takes you out of that experience. But by and large, I found over time that it feels just like working on my MacBook Pro. It's like my iPad Pro has suddenly become a little MacBook Pro, and it works pretty well. So I think that's going to be my workaround for a while. I think ultimately I still, in some instances, are going to want to take my MacBook Pro with me, depending upon what I know I'm going to be doing when I'm out and about. But certainly in a pinch, a VNC and SSH connection back to my Mac can solve a lot of the issues that I've been having. So that's where I'm at with my little experiment on the iPad Pro. If you have any questions or feedback about this, please shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last thing that I have for you today is my thing of the moment. I got a good one this week. You know, the holidays were just passed and we had friends and family over, and I've got a new Apple TV. I've been looking for ways to continue to use that to play games and have fun, more like party style games. And I don't know about you, but I like trivia. So I have been a fan of trivia applications, and I thought there's got to be some good trivia apps for the Apple TV. And I did a little searching and I found an application called Know It All. And this has a Jeopardy kind of like feel to it. You have a board basically on the screen, and it has a bunch of columns with questions centered around various topics. And then you have point values ranging from 100 to 400 points going down the column. And they have categories like movies, music, sports, sci-fi and fantasy, Star Wars, I think because the new Force Awakens movie has come out. And they also had a special Christmas category, which was kind of fun as we were playing with friends and family over the holidays. But basically, you fire up the application on the Apple TV, and then you connect to it. There is an iOS application that you put on your iPhone, your iPad, your iPod Touch that connects in, and then each iOS device becomes like the team that is going to be answering questions from the main control board, which is what your Apple TV is asking like. So the Apple TV is kind of like the host, and then each individual iOS device is the little team answering questions. And so what happens is the host controls the board using the Siri remote, and the different people who are playing will say, choose a question. And they might say, hey, I'll take animated movies for 300 points. And then you scroll over with the Siri remote to 300 points in the animated movie columns. You click on it, and then a question is displayed on the screen for 5 seconds. All players have a chance to read that question. And then after 5 seconds, up on their individual iOS device pops the answer, or the answers appear on screen with A, B, C, D. It's basically four options for answers. And then on the iOS device, you have buttons for A, B, C, D. And the first person to chime in with the, or team to chime in with the correct answer, gets the points and then control of the board, so they get to pick the next question from the list of categories. Now, if they attempt an answer and they get it wrong, what happens is control of the board passes back to the last player who correctly answered a question, and then play continues. So it goes back and forth like that. Each game consists of one round. There's only one round of 20 questions, so it's a 4x5 grid. I think you have the 100, 200, 300, 400 points, and then there's five different columns or question categories within each round based on the category that you're playing in. And it is a lot of fun. It's really fun to be going around. Each connected iOS device gets a random team name, and that's how you kind of keep track of who has control of the board and what's going on. I like it a lot. I do have a few minor quibbles with it. It'd be nice if you could pick your own team name. The team names are kind of funny and fun, but you don't have the option to customize that. It'd be nice to have the ability to buzz in and then be given a chance to do an answer. I think a problem I have with it is everybody answers at the same time. So it is possible just to take the tactic of, I'm just going to answer or just guess randomly and hope I get it right, and I'm going to answer more quickly before anybody else does, because there's really no penalty for getting it wrong. So it'd be great if you could buzz in and then attempt to answer, and then if you get the answer wrong, that another team could steal. And there still is kind of an opportunity for that, because if somebody answers wrong, the question is still open and you can continue to answer. So one strategy often is wait for, if you don't know the answer, wait for everybody to give a wrong answer. And then if you have two or three teams, there might only be one or two options left. So you might have a 50-50 or 100% chance of getting the right answer. But then you're doing that at the risk of, if they do know the answer, you've got to beat them out on, answering it more quickly. So there's that. I do wish there were more general categories than just the, movies, music, sports, sci-fi, fantasy. I think they're going to be adding more of those over time. It seems like they're going to have some room for expansion. I think it'd be nice if you could have more than one round. So if there was, maybe they didn't want to borrow so much from Jeopardy, but I think this would be great if you had, one round and then a double round and then, a final round question, just like Jeopardy would. I think that would be a lot of fun. But it's still a great family party trivia game for Apple TV. I think it's only $2 US, like $1.99. And it's great. So if you own a new Apple TV, check it out. Know It All. And it's on iTunes and great stuff. And that is my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question for me, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails and your audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you want to follow me on Twitter. My handle is twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you prefer Google Plus, we have a Google Plus community. You can find that at google.com/plusMacCast. And I look forward to seeing you online between shows, but that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.